This is the Breaker.News podcast for July 1st, 2018. Happy 151st anniversary, Canada. Welcome, I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, regular features like the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines about the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines about the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, the long-awaited report into dirty money at Metro Vancouver casinos. Peter German found that a systemic failure led to at least $100 million of money that was laundered through Metro Vancouver casinos. It involved deadly drugs and drove the price of housing up. And I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to people who made a difference. Now, is it just me?
Oh, Canada, standing tall together, we raise our hands and hail our flag, the maple leaf forever.
Is it just me, or should we be paying more attention to Coquitlam City Councillor Terry Towner? Towner proposed that municipal politicians around British Columbia stop deciding to give themselves pay raises. Why? Because it causes public distrust in local government. It is a conflict of interest. Towner proposed that the Union of BC Municipalities debate kicking the pay issue out of councils and into an independent agency, which can decide what fair pay really is for local politicians. Case in point, at City of Vancouver, Mayor Gregor Robertson was paid $168,000 last year. He lives in a penthouse in English Bay that is worth more than $3.1 million. He is finally leaving office this fall. He could always go back to peddling organic juice or running the Tides Foundation's Canadian office. Well, in 2016, Robertson and the Vision Vancouver Council voted themselves a 12% pay raise, and they started a pension scheme for outgoing council members. It's 1 week's pay per year served. In Robertson's case, he'll get $29,000 for being mayor since 2008. Some $103,000 will be paid to lame duck Robertson and the other five council members who will not run again. As Stephen Bohus from City Hall Watch says, the affordability crisis happened under their watch. Now they're getting bonuses as they leave City Hall. It's not right. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
The beaver builds dams because he has to store his winter's food in water deep enough not to freeze. For a more complete story of the beaver, why not contact the Canadian Wildlife Service in Ottawa?
Now it's time on the Breaker.news podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In Mexico News Daily, 132 political murders since September compared to just 9 6 years ago. There have been 132 candidates and politicians murdered since the electoral process began last September compared to just 9 during the 2011-2012 election period, says the latest report on political violence in Mexico. The numbers were revealed this week by the risk analysis firm Edelect, which has tallied 48 murders of candidates, up from just 1 6 years ago. Over half of all political violence in the 9-month electoral period leading up to the July 1st elections occurred in just 5 Mexican states. In the South China Morning Post, Louise Moon reports, Chinese tourists expelled from Malaysia for hot dance in front of mosque. Footage of a pair cavorting in front of a religious site triggered angry responses in Muslim-majority Malaysia. Two Chinese female tourists have been fined and thrown out of Malaysia after making a dance video in front of a mosque. Footage of Wan Han, 37, and Zhang Na, 25, dancing outside the Kota Kinabalu City Mosque was widely shared on social media under the heading Hot Dance and triggered an angry reaction in the majority Muslim country. The mosque's chairman denounced their inappropriate behavior and announced that visits would be suspended to protect the sanctity of Islam. Police fined the pair about $6.20 each, and they were escorted to the local airport where they boarded a flight back to China, Sohu's news site reported on Friday. And in the Japan Times from Kyoto News Service, media get peek at Hello Kitty bullet train ahead of debut. West Japan Railway Company showed a Hello Kitty-themed bullet train to the media before its debut. The white 8-car train, which is decorated with drawings of pink ribbons to mimic the look of the popular character created by Sanrio Company, was unveiled at a JR West facility in Fukuoka Prefecture. Daily round-trip runs between Shin Osaka Station in Osaka Prefecture and JR Hakata Station in Fukuoka. The car interiors of the special Shinkansen also feature images of the feline, such as Hello Kitty wearing a crew uniform or carrying local specialties on the walls, seats, and curtains. That's Around the Rim for this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. Czech TV reports RCMP confirm identities investigating deaths of Ryan Daly and Dan Archbold as a homicide. The remains of two bodies found near Ucluelet earlier this month have been identified as two missing sailors. Investigators are now treating the case as a homicide and not a random incident. Daly and Archbold were reported missing to Ucluelet RCMP in mid-May after they failed to contact family and friends following an 8-week sailing trip in Panama. The pair was last seen on surveillance video on May 16th at the Ucluelet boat dock. Police said they had been on Archbold's sailboat, the Astral Blue, that docked in Ucluelet on May 13th. In the Seattle Times, Rachel LaCorte of Associated Press reports former Washington State auditor sentenced to a year in prison. Former Washington State auditor Troy Kelly was sentenced June 29th to a year in prison following his December conviction on fraud and other charges related to when he ran a real estate escrow services business during the height of last decade's housing boom. Kelly ran a business called Post Closing Department, which tracked escrow paperwork for title companies. Prosecutors said that to obtain business from the title companies and access vast sums of money from homeowners, Kelly promised that Post Closing Department would collect $100 to $150 for each transaction it tracked. It would keep $15 or $20 for itself, use some of the money to pay county recording and other fees if necessary, and refund the customer any remaining money. In tens of thousands of cases, the additional fees were not needed, but Kelly retained the money anyway, prosecutors said. He refunded the balance only in a few instances when title companies began asking uncomfortable questions or when homeowners were savvy enough to demand it, prosecutors said. Kelly insists he was entitled to keep the money. And in the Oregonian, Douglas Perry reports, Skyjacker D.B. Cooper revealed real identity in 1972 letter to the Oregonian, Codebreaker claims. The infamous skyjacker known as D.B. Cooper revealed his real identity through a hidden message in a letter to the Oregonian on March 1972, just a few months after he parachuted from Northwest Orient Flight 305 and disappeared. That's the conclusion of a longtime Cooper case researcher who recently examined the letter with a former Army codebreaker. For the past couple of years, TV producer Thomas Colbert has been trying to convince the FBI that he and his team of retired law enforcement and military officers have figured out who Cooper is, a former paratrooper and Vietnam War veteran named Robert Rackstraw. Rackstraw, who is retired and living in the San Diego area, was an FBI suspect in the skyjacking until he was ruled out in 1979. The former paratrooper made teasing comments to the media in the late 70s, hinting that he could be the hijacker, but in recent years, he has insisted he is not D.B. Cooper. The mystery continues. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Anti-money laundering expert Peter German's Watershed Report was finally released on June 27th. In Dirty Money, German recommended the BC NDP government launch a new Crown Corporation to regulate gambling in BC and start a dedicated police force at casinos. More than $100 million has been laundered through Lower Mainland casinos, and German said evidence shows organized crime groups from China are involved in the illegal drug trade that used laundered money to buy Canadian real estate. German said River Rock Casino Resort in Richmond was the epicenter of activity, but no large casino was untouched. Attorney General David Eby pointed the finger at the previous BC Liberal government, which shut down a dedicated illegal gambling squad in 2009, despite warnings that loan sharking was leading to money laundering. German and Eby spent almost an hour speaking to reporters on June 27th. Here are the highlights.
Thanks to Dr. German's work, I can say now with absolute certainty that criminal money laundering is taking place in BC's casinos, and it has to stop. It's a serious crime with serious consequences for the people in British Columbia. Thanks to Dr. Peter German's work, I can tell you that it is tied to the opioid crisis that's taken thousands of people from their families. It's linked to the real estate market and housing prices that have made life unaffordable for British Columbians. The report itself paints a troubling picture of the last decade and a half. Dr. German has reported that for years, government turned a blind eye to escalating and troubling money laundering in BC casinos, despite abundant evidence that it was a serious problem. The first report was in 2011. Dr. German identifies that nobody said no. Nobody said, do not accept this money unless you know where it came from.
University of British Columbia law professor and former RCMP deputy commissioner, Peter German.
Unfortunately, for many years, Lower Mainland casinos unwittingly served as laundromats for the proceeds of organized crime. This represented a collective system failure which brought the gaming industry into disrepute in the eyes of many British Columbians. The problem was known as far back, as the minister has pointed out, as 2011. In that year, a report commissioned by the provincial government clearly stated that money laundering was occurring in casinos. The failure was not of one entity or person, but of the system. Fortunately, there are fixes which will prevent casinos from being used in the future as a tool for money laundering. I believe that the 48 recommendations in this report will accomplish precisely that goal, and I am gratified to hear that the province will be implementing those recommendations. So, who was doing this? Essentially, domestic and international organized crime through intermediaries was both loaning money to high rollers and hiring its own smurfs to gamble. What did they do? The gamblers, some of whom were dupes, turned small denomination bills into a more usable denomination or instrument. When did this occur? Loan sharking has been part of BC's casino industry since early days, but the high-end money laundering gained in intensity after 2010. Where did this occur? We know that the epicenter of activity was at the River Rock Casino Resort in Richmond, but no large casino was untouched. How much money was laundered? We can only guess at the true amount. Our best indicator is the thousands of suspicious currency transaction reports filed by casino operators through the years. The total well exceeds $100 million. Why did this occur? Because it could.
One question for David, one for Peter. First for David. How do you have confidence in keeping Jim Lightbody as CEO of BC Lottery Corporation and John Mazur as head of the Gambling Policy Enforcement Branch when they knew or ought to have known what was going on but didn't do enough?
So there were multiple reports that went to government. The 2011 report was authored by the BC Lottery Corporation that said that there was money laundering taking place in casino. I assign responsibility in this matter to the previous administration. They had many opportunities to take the action that we took in the first months of our government to say that unless you can prove the source of the cash you're bringing into the casino, it's not welcome. They also had the MNP report, which I released on coming into office, that had basically exactly that recommendation in it as well. So it's not like people weren't aware. It's not like government wasn't notified. In my opinion, the responsibility is with government to provide the direction, and the role of the Crown is to implement that policy.
Even though in 2007, the previous BCLC scandal, Vic Polishek was the CEO of BCLC, it was about lottery retailers winning prizes at their own lottery retail outlets, and he was fired. Why is this different? This seems to be a much more serious, especially when it comes to the drugs and organized crime. Lives are being lost in this case.
So certainly it was BCLC that was the author of the earliest report that Dr. German raised to our attention about this issue. They were the ones who were bringing this issue forward to government in part, as well as members of the Gaming Policy Enforcement Branch. And interestingly, in the report, it notes that the River Rock Casino was the organization that first said that we won't accept cash from known loan sharks that are bringing in this kind of cash. And so it, in my opinion, the responsibility lies with government, and the government has been removed.
Okay, one for Peter. I noticed the long, long list of people that were interviewed for this report includes Rich Coleman, a former minister in charge of both BCLC and GPEP. And it doesn't include the list, it doesn't include Mike DeYoung, who was the previous minister before Minister Eby, and doesn't include Thana Mentzelopoulos, who's the previous deputy minister before Mr. Fife. Were they not included? Did they cooperate at all or decide not to cooperate?
No. Thanks for the question, Bob. First of all, I think it has to be made very clear, this is not a fault-finding report. It's not a Royal Commission finding fault, trying to say who did what and who should be punished or whatever. We're looking forward, and this is a future, it's about structure and process. That's what this report is all about. However, before you can move ahead, you have to realize what the problem is. And so what I've attempted to do is document the issues through the years and form that basis for change. And hopefully that is what the report has accomplished in view of the fact that the minister has accepted the recommendations. Now, more specifically, there is reference in the report to the RCMP some news reports back in 2011, and the minister's, Mr. Coleman's, reaction to the news reports and the comments by the RCMP. So I thought, in fairness to Mr. Coleman, I should speak to him about that, and I did, and he was very cooperative. And I've documented that in the report. But as far as the Ministry of Finance and other ministries that have had responsibility for GPEP through the years, again, it's not a fault-finding exercise on my part, and I didn't have to go there for purposes of looking at structure and process.
Hello, my name is Yvette Brandom from CBC Vancouver. I'm curious, I realize, Mr. German, that it wasn't your intent to find fault and that wasn't the aim of this report, but I'm wondering why, and also if you could speak a bit to the apathy, because we've been hearing reports about this. I mean, we have public reports from FinTrack raising many of these issues back in 2008. Why did it take so long?
I can address the first piece because it was my direction to Dr. German about fault finding and his terms of reference. There is a mechanism in British Columbia that allows government to do an investigation similar to the review that Dr. German did. It's under the Public Inquiry Act. It is you can do essentially appoint a commissioner, and it's a desktop type inquiry. There's not testimony and so on, and you can develop a written report. The concern that I had about proceeding down that route, the benefit of it is that you can find fault. People are notified if they're at risk of having a finding made that they violated a law or a policy, whether criminal or civil or administrative. They're provided notice. They have the opportunity to retain counsel. If they're public servants, then it is possible that the public would be paying for their lawyers. And what we were looking at, in my opinion, was an exercise that would last probably a couple of years and would cost a significant amount of money. And on the other hand, we had a process like the one that Dr. German went through on the terms of reference that we delivered to him that was able to provide us with these very detailed findings and recommendations within a 10-month period, within a short period of time, so we could take action as quickly as possible. And we had cooperation from everybody that Dr. German approached to get information, so we didn't have to flip into that inquiry mode where we could compel information and also where there are protections for people where there's fault finding. The downside of trying to move quickly on this is the loss of some accountability, the loss of the ability to say this person violated this policy, this person violated that law. The upside of it is, and from British Columbians' perspectives, that we can act quickly to get dirty money out of our casinos and then move on to the next piece because we can't let organized crime get ahead of us.
Thank you. Frank?
What are the major countries where these organized crimes are based and are operated? Then how does the money flow between the countries or among the countries?
So every country has organized crime. We have homegrown organized crime. There is also international organized crime. We are, in many ways, a city. We look to Asia. So Asian organized crime has its tentacles in Vancouver, but not exclusively Asian organized crime. There's organized crime from various parts of the world that has a bit of a seat here. Organized crime, and I've tried to explain it in the report, is not what you might have read in your criminology textbooks 10, 15, 20 years ago. These days, it is very much a moving target. You have loose alliances between organized crime organizations. We've seen that in the Lower Mainland right at the street level, but you certainly see that internationally. And where it becomes very complicated is when organized crime groups actually are involved in both legal and illegal enterprises at the same time. So, you know, definitely there's an Asian organized crime component. I've talked about that in the report. But it's not exclusively that. And you know, picking up on what the minister said, at the end of the day, if we're talking about drug trafficking proceeds being laundered, who is buying the drugs, right? So it's actually people in this province that are buying the drugs, or in whatever other province, state, or country where the money comes from. So it's easy to point the finger elsewhere, abroad, and so forth, but we also have to realize that drug sales occur, illegal drug sales, right here, and that money gets laundered right here.
For more coverage of the money laundering scandal in BC casinos, read thebreaker.news.
The loon is also called the Great Northern Diver. For a more complete story of the loon, why not contact the Canadian Wildlife Service in Ottawa?
Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or group of people that have made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to... to you, to all of you in Canada, to Canadians everywhere, for being Canadian. Have a safe and happy Canada Day, and long live the true North, strong and free. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news.
Okay, everyone, like, this is me on the drums,
oh,
eh?
Get out. It is not.
It is
not.
So.
Stop
I
lying,
learned.
Will you?
Take off, eh?
Oh,
take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beautiful.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for July 1st, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on July 1st, 1980, O Canada became the official national anthem? Well, now you know. Send your feedback, send your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.